What's up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Think Like the Enemy. Today, I have a very special guest with me, the host of the Present Fathers podcast, a podcast that I unbelievably founded by just accident because it just landed on my X feed. And I think it's something the algorithm designed it so people that live close by can link up. The actual conversations had in this podcast are very interesting from a lot of very different perspectives, but with one thing in mind, that fatherhood is one of the most important jobs that any man can have. With me today is Mr. Dustin Burnham. How are you doing, sir? It is always a pleasure to have wonderful people on the podcast, my friend. And what I found interesting was that, like you were saying, you find your podcast listenership to be between three different platforms. And for me, it's the same case. So it is really wonderful to see that the X algorithm is trying to put people together that are like-minded, that have a similar view on the things that are happening in America today. And more so on our coast, because that's like a lot of times we see that not a lot of people are talking about the things that are happening in Florida. So yeah. One thing that I noticed that you brought up when we were off camera was that the Silicon Valley of California, it's no more. We're seeing, and you guys talked about it in your podcast, that they have actually moved out here to Florida and they're starting something new here. So if I may, I'm going to share the clip with the listeners and the viewers so they can listen to it and we can talk about it a little bit.
Yeah.
Awesome. Let's see if it loads, guys. Sorry that it's loading a little bit. Let's see if it goes over there. That's okay. I'll just edit this part out. It should have done it.
Of course, yeah. I'm the same. So I teach anesthesia. And whenever I want to show a video, it's all loaded up and ready to go. And then I click play. And I got 30 students waiting there.
Just and you're like staring come at that on, screen. Man. That's okay. Yes. That's the way it happens. Thankfully, we have the power of editing, which I think is something that
we as an immigrant, what do you see differently?
Let me see. We're going to put it on minute number six, I think it was, right, Dustin?
I think that was pretty close. Yep.
All right. Let's
get it right here. So sitting there, two months prior. I just thought, was like, you know what? You know, I disagreed with him a lot over the prior 2 months because I thought what he was doing was crazy. But I just thought, was like, you know what? Fuck it. Maybe he's right. Like, these people are just so crazy in the local government here. Maybe we really do need to move Silicon Valley to Miami. And so it was sort of this, like, pithy, sarcastic tweet in some ways where, like, the prior 2 months I've been critiquing Miami. And then obviously, you know, someone on a dime, you know, sort of flipped on it and said, yeah, hey, maybe we should move the whole ecosystem there. At the time, I still wasn't actually able to go visit, you know, Miami and really see it from this, like, professional lens. Because up until then, I'd only visited for, like, you know, bachelor parties, like, weekend trips type thing. But after our first board meeting at BARDA after, you know, our Q1, I basically decided, hey, now's the time where I can afford to go check out the ecosystem, go work in the Founders Fund office, you know, out there. And I remember I arrived on a Sunday, you know, evening to Miami. Monday morning, I have this, like, Cafecito, you know, basically interview with the, you know, mayor of Miami, Frank Suarez. And the first question he asked me in Cafecito was, like, hey, when are you? You can go look up the interview. At the time, you can say, like, hey, good luck. Like, you know, I have my office in San Francisco. I got this company that I'm just starting in LA. It'd be really hard for me to, like, you know, drive myself, you know, off of the West Coast. And then, you know, literally over the course of the week, basically, you know, flipped my entire mind on it, where I just found that I was, like, so much happier. I was so much more productive. There was sunlight. The food was, like, more Mediterranean, which felt like better, you know, fit for me. And so by the end of the week, I was like, what the hell am I doing? I felt like I basically, like, unlocked myself from the Stockholm syndrome, where I was just like, I don't actually need to be in San Francisco.
That's so cool.
None of my investments are in San Francisco. Founders Fund has an office out here. I'm happier. I'm more productive here. I work harder. Like, I'm going to be fitter here because I'm going to spend more time outdoors doing activities. It's just like, I can find no justification for why I actually need to be in San Francisco.
I love it.
And the BARDA thing I can manage by just
trying to do a day a week. Like, you just feel this positive vibe. You're like, oh my God, I want to work for this guy.
More time than, you know,
yeah. I was spending before. Well, he's got a super interesting story. I'll give you a quick synopsis
on
it.
Sure, I would love to.
So Delian was a teenager when his parents moved to California from Bulgaria. Communist, falling apart, terrible economy, lots of problems. So they moved to America. He goes to college. He gets into MIT, one of the top schools in the country.
Amazing.
And he gets paid by a guy named Peter Thiel, who founded PayPal, to drop out of school. So if you've never heard of this, it's called the Thiel Fellowship. And this guy is crazy. He takes top college students and says, look, you're wasting your time being in school. You could be building something right now. So he pays them $200,000 to build a company. So Delian was one of those people. He built a different company before Varda and then sold that and then got into space manufacturing. So basically what they do is they use a SpaceX rocket. Okay. They shoot medications up at altitude. They make the medication, they bring it back down, and there's certain things that can only be made at zero or low gravity. Okay. So the nucleation point of the medication changes.
Okay.
Kidney medications, in their case, it's AIDS, antiretroviral, only possible to be done at altitude. And so they just did proof of concept last month. It's wild stuff. Yeah.
That's
so
amazing.
Founders Fund is a multi-billion dollar company. They've seeded every company you can imagine, you know, from SpaceX, all these different. And so moving from Silicon Valley, where all the big companies are, you know, Google, Apple, all those guys, they're all in California. Moving that company led to a lot of other big companies to start moving to Miami. And so there's this big push to now make a Silicon Valley essentially in Miami. And it's,
that's amazing.
Yeah.
I hours south of us. The actual impact that it will have in California from the taxation standpoint, right? And the culture, how is it going to shift, you know, eventually to the point that it's going to be, okay, so what are we doing wrong here? Like, why are people moving away? Because this is not the first multimillionaire, multi-billionaire that I've heard saying, I can't deal with this anymore. Like, I need to go elsewhere. So I find it just tremendous. And I wonder how his how the employees are adjusting here as well. You know, just thinking again, you know, like the title of the podcast, think like the enemy. So I think, like, you know, what is the perception culturally in the company and how they're able to accomplish either more or less? Like, you know, but it sounds like they're doing great out here. I'm very
big. Yeah, I think the biggest difference for them is that in San Francisco, you really can't prosecute a petty crime. Right. If someone breaks into your car or even sometimes minor forms of assault.
Right.
There's really nothing you can do. That's not the case in Florida. If you break the law, you will be prosecuted.
Correct. Yeah.
And if you are someone who does not like to break the law, but does enjoy the benefits of law and order, you're going to get tired of that in California eventually.
Yes.
Yes, it's mean to take criminals who maybe had a tough childhood and put them in jail. It's not a nice thing to do. But it's also not nice to attack people on the street. So you kind of have to look at it and say, okay,
it's kind of like a double-edged sword on here.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Now I have a son, so I have a 4-year-old son and he has cerebral palsy and epilepsy. So when we found out his actual diagnosis, we were like, okay, we should be closer to family. And that's how we landed in Florida, because it's in plane ride from Puerto Rico. Not that anybody within our family has helped us at all, which is the truth. And I'm okay with that. But one of my aunts, she's a pharmacist here in Florida. And she was like, hey, come to my house, stay with me as long as you need it, get your feet up and go forward and do what you got to do. So that's how I landed in Florida. It wasn't by design or anything like that. I've lived in Florida before. I lived in Hernando County before when I was a child. For about a year and a half, my parents decided that they wanted to move from Puerto Rico to Florida, like every other Puerto Rican. So, yeah, and it was like, okay, so we move here. They stayed for a little bit, then we went back. But then it wasn't my first choice. But then I started seeing a little different perspective on Florida. And that was growing on me, and I love Florida. Because like you said, you know, petty crime sometimes, can it be prosecuted to the extent that it's a little unfair to the individual? Absolutely. But then do we like the ability to say, I feel safe in my home and going grocery shopping with my kid? And more so for me that I have a disabled child. And thankfully he's doing great. He's a little 4-year-old terror. You know what I mean? Like he's just, you know, he's so great, but it's part of the growing pains that we have as parents and as, you know, for our children as well. So I feel a little bit safer living here in Florida and I understand why they did the push. And with that being said, now that we know that this particular company is sending medications out to space to make sure that they provide the best product out there, we have a news tying it to it from NASA. NASA space junk that crashes through Florida home came from the ISS, survived reentry. I know that you are somebody that loves space, you know, you love the rockets and everything else like that. So I'm gonna play this clip for us, about a minute long.
Let's see what we have. Piece of debris.
Let's go back.
What is this strange object?
Well, at the moment, no one is 100% sure, but they're fairly certain it fell from space. A few weeks ago, a piece of debris fell through a Florida man's roof, going through two floors of his Naples home before coming to rest near his son. The man named Alejandro Otero posted on X that he believes it was a piece of a battery pallet that was jettisoned from the International Space Station in 2021. It was meant to re-enter Earth's atmosphere and burn up on March 8th. The very same day, it came crashing into his home. NASA has since released a statement saying, quote, NASA collected an item in cooperation with the homeowner and will analyze the object at NASA's Kennedy Space Center in Florida as soon as possible to determine its origin. Astrophysicist Jonathan McDowell has already made an assertion that while the battery pallet was meant to burn up over Fort Myers, Naples could have been along the way. So what went wrong? Could NASA have made such an error? Well, an expert at Ars Technica said that the battery pallet was actually launched by Japan's space agency, not only making the pallet's re-entry more complicated, but perhaps also determining liability for damages.
Okay. Well, that is a very interesting piece of news, right?
That's crazy. Can you imagine?
Dude, I thankfully I live in a one-story home, but it would just land on the floor and I would be like, well, that happened. You know, like, what am I supposed to do? Like, like, it's just so funny. But tying the joke to that would be like, so did they measure the actual trajectory of this particular piece of debris falling in on the metric system, or did they do it on the American system? Like, they made the correction for Mars. You know, I thought that was a little funny. When I saw it, I was like, I know Dustin's going to get a kick out of that.
That's crazy. Right. Well, so have you heard of the Kepler effect?
I have not, no.
That rang a bell. So it's a potential problem that may happen with all the satellites we have up in low Earth orbit. Basically, okay, if a couple satellites smash into each other, they would break apart and we'd have a bunch of space debris all going 10,000 miles an hour.
Oh, so lovely. Now,
yeah. Yeah. So now we shoot rockets up
on my end.
Yeah, seriously. And so if that were to happen, it's very hard to clear that space junk and debris because it's going so fast. They're all like these high powered missiles. So the fear is that, let's say the Space Force in America gets into conflict with China somehow, and we have a couple of satellites shooting lasers at each other, right? Who knows in the future?
Right. We never know.
They destroy each other. And now you have all this space junk. And it's not like on Earth where you can just clear it up, you know? So it could become a major issue in the future. If you get a chance, it's not too far from you.
Sure.
The,
yeah, yeah.
The Space Force Museum is up in Cape Canaveral, mm-hmm, probably 45 minutes north of you.
Yeah.
And the whole reason the Space Force was created was to protect our communication systems, our satellites. Because if we lose our internet, I mean, we're not going to have podcasts. And if we don't have podcasts, what's the point of living? Yeah.
Right. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. What are we going to do?
This is the peak of civilization right here.
Right. No, it's funny because when Space Force actually got started, I was getting out of the military and I was looking at it like, what are we doing? Like, what are you doing?
The and Guardians. Yeah.
I'm like, they look like the freaking stormtroopers. Like, they just look horrible. And I was one of those guys.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, NORTHCOM actually does this. Like, the Air Force literally has like a wing for this crap right now. Like, what are we doing? So yeah, then I started thinking about it. I was like, wait a minute. It kind of makes sense. You know, we have NASA. We have the Air Force. We have the Army. We have the Marines. Like, maybe the next war is going to be fought in space. We don't know.
Yeah.
Which we can see in with, you know, the actual capabilities that Iran launched the other day on Israel and everything else like that, that how they actually went into the atmosphere and came back down, the missiles.
I heard about that. It was the first exoplanetary like attack, right? It was so crazy. I don't know how to, maybe you can describe it better.
Yeah, it's basically, so the difference between the ballistic and the I'm drawing a blank right now. So you have your regular ballistic missile, and then you have your conventional weaponry. It's the actual altitude in which they come in. So they have a hypersonic missile that they launch, which they did, but they didn't, because they haven't never said it publicly yet. They said that they didn't launch it, but they have the capability. But yet again, the actual Israeli Air Force came out and said, no, we were up there. We shot it down before it came down. So I was like, huh. You know, it's a very interesting point in where we are in our world today. And it's one that I'm keeping a very close eye on. So for my particular background, I am doing a degree actually in international relations and global security with a concentration on the Middle East. So this just ties into everything that I'm doing right now in school. I'm like not even a year away from finishing because I did it while I was in the military, but never got the degree for it. So now I want to get back into the actual, you know, Department of Defense in another capacity as a civilian. So I need the degree to actually get in. So now I'm kind of like looking at this particular issue in the Middle East a little bit closer. When it was happening, I was actually live with another podcast, the one from Texas that I was telling you about when we were off. It's called the Free Speech Podcast. And we were sitting down and, you know, actually doing 15-minute segments on every update that we were seeing and the Iron Dome and the capabilities. And, you know, it's really interesting what's happening.
Iran is a powerful, I had no idea how powerful their military is.
They are. They're very powerful. Yes, sir.
What, give me a quick synopsis. What do you think the chances are if Iran, God forbid, decided they wanted to attack Israel and really go into a hot war? Sure. What's that look like to you?
Okay, so let's play the scenario real quick that something actually came from Iran in response to another retaliation from Israel. Mm-hmm. So for this particular notion, it would look a little bit more in the way of a ground attack first, and they will do like a no-kidding kind of occupation, if possible, without intervention from any other of the allies that are willing to actually go in and protect, you know, nation of Israel. Mm-hmm. If I was thinking like them, I would definitely try to take out as much of the Iron Dome as I can, and there are three other layers because they have three different layers of protection. It depends on, you know, regular ballistic missiles, regular drones, and it goes with a range of actual, we could say weaponry that will mitigate those attacks. So the layers, I will try to take at least two of the layers out, increasing my chances to actually attack, you know, the mainland Israel. I will start with any place of government communication, water, electric, everything like that. That's what it would look like on their end. The problem is that it is not sound and smart for Iran to actually attack Israel. Because now you have that there's a pledge from Russia, China, and pretty much everybody in the BRICS nations saying that, and this is something that I have discussed in the past for, I would say, many, many years. When BRICS got started, it was all about economic sanctions and pulling back from that, right? They don't want those sanctions. Their economy is being hurt. So not being able to transact under SWIFT, it was hurting their economy. 20 years have passed. Now they have their own economic growth on their own financial sector. What is the next step? If you have the backing financially, the next step is military. So now, since this attack on Israel, now the BRIC nations, some of them have said, no, we'll back you if somebody comes and messes with you. So then you will have the Third World War. It is not...
So it'd be kind of a NATO against BRICS kind of scenario, essentially?
It could potentially be, but okay. We have to think, how willing will these, let's say three nations for that matter, be as in essence to go against NATO as a whole? Like how willing are they going to be? What is their actual manpower looking like? What is their military experience looking like right now? The only ones that have experience right now, in all honesty, it's pretty much Russia. And they're exhausting their actual troops when it comes to the fighting in Ukraine. China doesn't have, they have the manpower, they have the military might, but they don't have the experience.
Yeah.
On the other end, we're coming out of the experience cycle. Because if you think of the last war that we fought, Iraq and Afghanistan, where people are starting to retire now. Every veteran that was out there, like myself, I retired already 10 years ago. So if I was still in, I would literally be 2 years away from retirement. So you don't have those people that actually went out there, did conventional warfare, did actual urban warfare. How are you going to fight? So now we're dealing with that kind of scenario. It's not a good scenario for anybody in the mix. So if I was to be a betting man, I will bet that Israel will do some kind of attack in response, and they'll go back and forth for a little bit, and then it should fizzle out. Should. But it is to be determined, because we don't know how fast and how willing is Iran to actually engage in a hand-to-hand combat or an actual, you know, like a no-kidding war just for the kicks of it. I don't know. We don't know what they're thinking right now.
So we're seeing these new powerful drones.
We are.
How do you think that's going to play into it? Do you think the Iron Dome is equipped to deal with thousands, potentially millions of these new drones?
They are equipped to deal with the majority of them, because since they're low altitude and the actual technology, which is pretty much, it's our technology. So the way that it is designed to deal with it, it deals in a cluster. So it just fires, you know, think about a buttload of bullets, a BLB, and it just, brrr, that, you know, that's pretty much what it is. That's what we called it. So it was like, brrr, and it just fizzles out. So that's why for them, you know, thinking again, you know, think like Iran, the one thing that would be imperative for them is to take the capability of the Iron Dome down, period. They have a very good cyber, you know, program in their actual country. They did shut down the radar for about 6 hours when they did their attack on Saturday. So,
true.
Right. So it's a lot of moving pieces. And, you know, the more people you have within an actual structure like so, the harder it gets for the information to stay, you know, ironclad for that matter. So.
So speaking of last month, we all lost cell phone reception all in Florida for the day. What were we told? That it was just a little network error?
Of course, yeah. I think it was more of a white flag, you know, capabilities testing. Think about it. If you're going to go and hit something, the same way that Iran just did with, you know, with Israel, if you're going to go and hit something, you want to test how far you can disrupt the networks. So how far could they get? They got me for about 6 hours, I think it was, right? It was like, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning, something like that. Funny thing was that my kid was actually sick that night. And he was throwing up, and he was like having like a miserable day. We had just gotten out of the hospital with epilepsy that night. I woke up with a kid just covered in puke, man, from head to toe. And I'm like, I need Pedialyte right now. I forgot where my close by Walmart was not open because it was like 4 o'clock in the morning. So there's a 24-hour one like in Melbourne. And I was like, I don't know how to get there. I'll wing it. I'll use land navigation. I'll go. So I literally went, started driving, got there, got my stuff back. Still no cell phone reception. And I'm like, what's going on? Like, what are going on here, man? I don't know.
Did it make you think, like, as a dad, if that were to happen for a month? I mean, who knows? It's not likely, but it's certainly possible. We just have no cell phone or internet for a month. How do we prepare for that kind of scenario?
Well, my friend, let me tell you something. Being from the island of Puerto Rico, I am known to live without everything. So when Hurricane Maria happened, I actually was living in Puerto Rico. So I went without electric for 8 months, without water for about 6 months in my neighborhood. No internet for about a year. And I was basically getting reception. Like, I look like the crazy tinfoil man, you know, like, where can I get it? Right here. Okay, good. Let me call the family abroad. And we call them. Okay, hey, we're alive. Okay, bye. That's it.
Yeah.
So for me, no problem whatsoever. For a lot of the people in America that depend 100% on the internet, I do not know what they can do.
Yeah.
For me, brother, I will be pulling out cards. I'll be playing outside with little trucks with my little boy. There's no water. Okay, let's go find a natural spring. Oh, there's gators. I got a gun. We'll shoot them. We just need a little bit of water. They'll leave us.
There you go.
You know, like, come on now.
And there's a lot of meat on those gators.
Absolutely. Because God will provide, my friend. So
I love it.
It's just funny, right? Because how dependent would you say that you are from the internet?
I am not good with directions at all.
Okay, gotcha.
And I was getting better, so I'm 40 years old now.
Gotcha.
And it was around when I was probably about 20 years ago, right? That GPS became a really big thing.
Everyone started having it. And everybody had one, you know? Yeah.
And so I started relying on it and allowed myself to become weaker and weaker at directional skills.
Okay.
And so I use GPS all the time, obviously to get to and from work and things like that. I don't need it. But if you were to tell me, I need you to find a specific store in Palm Bay,
you're like,
I would struggle with that. I would, you know, I'd need to get out a map and really, it would take me a while to figure it out because I'm so reliant upon GPS. So that's the primary struggle that I would have is with directions.
Okay.
So maybe that's a skill set that I need to start working with on my son. That could be a good
practice.
Yeah. To get to both of us where, you know, we talk about what's your address, how would you get home?
Yeah.
He's not quite there yet. He's like your son. He's 4 years old.
Gotcha.
But it helps if you know how to do it. You know, then you're going to do a better job of helping them as well.
Yeah. Well, for me, it kind of helps too, because I was a carrier, like I was a mail carrier. So I was in the city side and on the rural side. So I just look at something and I'm like, okay, I'm going east or west. We'll find it eventually. We'll get there. So I just kind of wing it just the same way that the post office does every single day. So it's like, oh.
And being on the water is pretty easy, right? Yeah. If the water is on one side, you know you're going a certain direction. So right. It makes things a little bit simpler there. But it is something I definitely need to work on because without GPS, I definitely am lost.
You would struggle. Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I find it that even with, you know, saying that GPS is definitely something that I depend on, I think we all do. There's no American that can tell you, I don't depend on GPS. Bro, we all depend on GPS.
Like, yeah. No, yeah.
I just took a road trip to Washington, D.C. I could have gotten there without a GPS, but it made my life a lot easier that I had one. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think also survival skills in general. Like we don't know what the next 20 years are going to bring to us, geopolitically speaking. We honestly don't. So what are some of the skills that we can work on or having a network? And this is why, to me, this space is something that is a creative outlet, but it's also a way to create a little bit of awareness, right? You are in the medical field. That is 100% the one skill that everybody's going to look for if something hits the fan, right? 100%.
Yeah. Yep.
It's going to be like, oh, who's going to take care of us when we're sick? Or who's going to, you know, dress our wounds or whatever the case might be?
Yeah.
Who can get water? Who can go foraging? Who can, all this kind of stuff. I'm not saying that that will happen in the next 20 years. I'm just saying that it's something nice to pass down to your son or your daughters if you have one. So in the future, they can pass it down to their generations and so forth, so on. Because I know it was passed down to me. And it wasn't necessarily from my dad, which I did have him in my life, but it was more a combination of everybody around us, from my grandfather, grandmother, my mother, aunts, uncles, everybody. We knew how to actually farm. We all do. I have an actual garden in my backyard, and we're farming right now. And we do it with very minimal time, very minimal money. That's it. It's just something that we're accustomed to. So in your perspective, would you say that, and I remember, you know, watching your story and everything else like that, is that something that you feel comfortable with doing and showing your son eventually in the future? You know, something like farming or something within the lines of like a survival skill or something like that?
He absolutely loves gardening.
Oh, that's so awesome.
Strawberries and blueberries, probably the same stuff, you know, you have in your yard. And they're easy to grow. That's one of another great thing about Florida is you stick it in the ground and it just grows. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
So that's he loves it. He tells the difference. He can tell me, oh, that's a store-bought blueberry.
Really? Versus,
oh, that's a fresh one that's from the garden. I prefer
that. That's so cool.
Yeah. And so that's something that my wife is a great gardener. We do it together. It's a fun family activity. And he absolutely loves it. Every day he runs out to go check on the strawberries. Well, he's not checking on them. He's going to pick them to eat
them. But, that's so cool.
So that's a great survival skill right there.
Yeah.
I was a Boy Scout. And so
Yeah,
some survival skills, how to get outside. My son's favorite place is the outdoors. And so the more I can teach him about camping, about enjoying nature, not only from a mental health and from an exercise perspective, but if for some reason we didn't have available the comforts of home for a while, it would be very important to have that skill set.
And that's so cool.
So that is definitely a legacy and something that I want to pass down to him is how to enjoy the outdoors and how to handle it and how to be a minimalist to where you don't need 100 things to go camping. You know, if you have to pack 4 cars full of stuff,
to
go camping, you're doing it wrong. Right. So, less is more in that regard. So that's a great question. And definitely want to pass that stuff down to my son.
We love camping as well. We go to, Jetty Park.
Yeah.
Yep. We go to Jetty Park. My brother-in-law, he actually lives in Kissimmee. So whenever they have like any kind of birthday or anything like that, they're going camping. So we just tag along or we go and visit them for the day. For my particular situation, we have to pack a little extra because we have anti-seizure medications. We have kid that's allergic to bug bites, but we still let him do all the things and then we'll just deal with him in the afternoon. We just carry a nice little first aid kit with us. We carry whatever we're going to use that day, whatever we're going to use on the weekend and everything else like that. Enough, plenty of water. Or a way to get it, and that's it. So we try.
I love that you do that because so many dads were so I can't let my child get hurt at all. No. I have to protect them, and especially with a child with special needs, you say, oh well, he's got these special needs, so I can't let anything happen. Right. I'm going to protect him, and that is not good for kids. No. You have to do it. You have to let them get those bug bites, and then here's how to treat it. You have to to a point, right? You don't want him like getting into shock all the time. Right, you know, right.
Something he's supposed to do. Yeah, like, already got epilepsy to deal with. Like, I don't need another shock on his body, right? So yeah, no, it's funny because thankfully he's not that severe. Like, he will go into like an anaphylactic shock or anything like that. You know, thank God for that. But it's enough that you kind of look at it and you're like, that can become cellulitis at some point. So let's go ahead and treat that right now. Let's go get some antibiotic. So if I ever look at my son when we're camping and he's not covered from head to toe with dirt, I am doing it wrong. Like, literally. No, yeah. Literally. Because he's just like, you're like, okay, can I just put you inside the washing machine so you can get clean right now? Because you're filthy, bro. Like, you're done.
That's what it's going to take.
Yeah. So, yeah, we definitely, a lot of our close friends and families, you know, they go like, dude, you guys are great. And I was like, why? I was like, well, because you're letting him do all these things. Like, somebody in your same situation, like you said, Dustin, it's like, they'll be like, no, we have to protect him. He's so, no. Oh, you drop that on the floor in the dirt? Okay, well, it goes down the hatch. Don't worry about it. It's okay, buddy.
He's 5 second rule.
Yeah, they're looking at me like, I was like, just let him be a kid. Like, I'm not going to be, he has to go through enough trauma already. He's 4 years old. He's been through 3 major surgeries. Like, do I really, you know, like, come on. What am I supposed to do? Like, I'm not going to shelter him in this bubble and like, oh my God, I love you so much. I do love him. I will give my life for this kid.
Yeah.
But in the same token, if I want to be an example to him and somebody that is actually bringing benefit to his life, like a true father should, then this is part of the growing. This world is not designed for my son. Like, in all honesty, it is not. And that is the truth. So what do? Okay. I'll tell you what we did. We bought him a kitchen. And you'll be like, a boy with a kitchen? A lot of people in our generational bracket will be like, oh, that's wrong. It's like, no. We bought it like an actual kitchen that he can actually start learning what it is to be on top of a sink. He has motor skill deficiencies on the right side because of a stroke. So I need to show him that he can do things. So we buy like all the little, you know, like cookware. Not that he can actually use it with heat or anything like that, but it's just a practice on the occupational side that he can start learning a whisk, trying to move it with his good arm or his bad arm. It doesn't matter. Same thing with plates. He brings his plate when he's done to the actual sink because he does it in his actual kitchen. So his room is designed basically to be that operation or occupational therapeutic component for his life in the future.
I love that.
Yeah. So it is something that, you know, has it been a struggle? Yeah, but then I have a switch, man. As a father, I definitely have a switch. And I go on the logical mode more than the emotional side. Because when it deals with something that is going to impact them in the future, I don't need to be your friend. I don't need to be your emotional support. And I need to be your father. And this is what we're going to do. And this is how we're going to get there, buddy. And I explain to him. And he understands. He's there. It's just motor skills, speech is a little affected, and that's that. So I find that interesting, you know, being able to have grown with him on that sense, because I find that a lot of parents have a lot of issues understanding they need to accustom to themselves to the growing of the other individual you have in front of you, you know, meaning your child. So he's learning as he's growing. How are you going to demand something from him when he doesn't know who he is yet? So that to me is, you know, something that is important for sure.
I love that you're teaching him that. And that's something that he can't learn on his own. You know, you're the only person who can do that for him. And he's very lucky to have you to
make that happen. I appreciate that. Yeah.
We're gonna set him up for success.
Yeah, I wish my dad would have done some of the things that I do with my son, but I understand he was from a different generation, man. Like my father, he was a very absent father. He really was. He was there, but he really wasn't. But my father, at the age of 14, had to drop out from school because he found his mother crying in the kitchen because she hadn't eaten for 3 days just to give her kids something to eat. So you have a mother, single mother, you know, her husband died on an actual, funny enough, it's not really funny, my great-grandfather. But he was bitten by stung by a bunch of bees, and he died because he was allergic, and nobody knew it.
Gosh,
it was back in the 50s, so it was like, like, you know, okay, well, he passed. So then my dad had to take that role and he had to become a man without really knowing what a man was, because he didn't have a father. 14
is young for that. Yeah.
14. Like, are you kidding me? He was working. She found out that he was working because one day he came in with his school clothes and they were bloodied on the shoulders because he was carrying, you know, like these expert soda, like cans that you have for like the crackers. He was carrying those full of concrete up like four flights of steps every single day to go and work in construction. So that's kind of like, okay. So I get it why some of the things, the components that I am teaching my son, he didn't have them. I get it. That's okay. But now it's like my turn to actually bring all that together with that struggle that my dad had and shape somebody to be a good man in the future. And I hope he, you know, he turns out okay.
And it's very healing for you, isn't it? Everything that absolutely. You can give to your son, it's like you're healing yourself in the process. Yeah, yes. My dad wasn't around either, and it's a very similar experience. Every mm-hmm. time I'm able to give my son something I didn't have, a little piece of me comes back and heals, yeah. And it just feels incredible.
That's why I say every time, you know, when somebody tells me, it's like, you know, what do you think your son is to you? And I'm like, in all honesty, he's a person that actually kept me alive. He really has, because when I got out of the military, I was completely alone. Like, I felt like the worst human being possible, just alone, just done. And I started in a very self-destructive path. I started drinking every single day, using drugs, just doing all this stupid stuff that anybody can think of. So now to be, you know, be able to say, I'm a father, it's like, whoa, okay. You know, it either makes you or breaks you as a man. That's it.
Yeah.
It doesn't do anything else, you know, in my perspective. Because you see so many people that just don't care. And I'm like, yeah, how can you not care? Like, that's your, you know, your son, man. Like, you have to give him everything. So.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's move on to another thing because we kind of went on a tangent over there. But I love it.
Yeah,
well,
sorry.
I love it. I really do. Yeah. Okay, so we have that in Florida. Going back to our news, you know, stories for the day. Florida joins Texas banning local heat protection for outdoor workers. And here we go with the news.
A new study suggests extreme heat could cost employees who work outside billions of dollars. The Union of Concerned Scientists, along with researchers at the University of California, Merced, say that between now and 2065, climate change is projected to quadruple outdoor workers' exposure to hazardous heat conditions. More and more, the situation will jeopardize their health and place up to $55.4 billion of their earnings at risk if no action is taken to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The study suggests the average outdoor worker in installation, maintenance, and repair services stands to lose the most annual income at approximately $2,200 due to extreme heat.
So I'm confused by this. The headline doesn't seem to match the story.
Correct.
So are Florida and Texas not doing greenhouse gas emissions, or are they not protecting workers?
They're not protecting workers. But okay. The way that it got tied into that, that's what I thought it was interesting, right?
Yeah.
So, and we can read from the actual news article. Florida will become the second state to stop local governments from requiring heat protection for outdoor workers after Republican Governor Ron DeSantis signed House Bill 433. The law, which DeSantis signed last week, goes into effect on July 1st and establishes multiple restrictions for city and county governments, including or the ability to set heat exposure requirements not already required under state and federal law.
Yeah.
So additional requirements will not basically be in effect in Florida. So whatever you have for heat protection is what you get. So it's not up to the government to do anything about it anymore.
Okay, and they're saying that people will lose their jobs if they force businesses to provide heat protection.
Right. I think this goes in line with the same notion that California is actually giving $20, you know, an hour wages to fast food workers. So here we're trying to, I think, right, we're trying to bring as much business as possible here. So they don't want them to think that they have to spend extra money on that. It's not preventing the employee itself from protecting himself. But then is it fair for the employee to actually inquire on additional costs for something that they are required to do, like doing their job?
I could see a lot of scenarios where this doesn't go well.
It doesn't. I don't think it's the best best piece of legislation or bill to be passed in, you know, in the state of Florida for sure. How can you, as an employer, sit there and say, oh, okay, well, thank you. You know, I don't have to spend $150 on the summer for my employees to do their job. Like, really? Like,
I don't know. I need to know kind of what other states require as far as heat protection. Because right. if it's this onerous, you know, backbreaking amount of stuff that you literally can't do your business that way, then I kind of get it.
Right.
But if it's, you know, a little bit of water and some shade available, then, right. you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with having legislation saying we're going to protect. I mean, we don't allow hot cars and babies, right?
Right.
You know, if you're caught as a dad, if you leave your kid in a hot car, you will get arrested for that, even if the kid is okay.
Yeah.
And I'm okay with that. I mean, yeah, that's a good, you know. Yeah, we don't need to have people leaving their, you know, their kids in cars. Absolutely. And so the same kind of thing here. I mean, the heat is no joke in Florida.
Buddy.
And yeah.
I've been in the desert before, my friend. I spent a year in Iraq and bro, like, and this heat here is no joke. The humidity just kills. It's like.
So did you have any kind of heat protection available to you while you were in the military? Or is that a ridiculous question?
Okay. No, it's not a ridiculous question. They gave us, you know, the standard issue, you know, crap, basically. And okay. they made sure that we were hydrated 1,000% at all times. They really did. But yet again, when we landed in Iraq, when we traveled from Kuwait to Iraq, people were getting off the helo and then they were just dropping. It was like, we're getting out of Black Hawk. And it's like, like out of 5-2 drop. And you're like, okay, well, let's drag them to the shade. You know, like, they're exhausted. Like,
yeah.
So we did have it, but at the end of the day, in all honesty, it was more on the individual and the first line supervisor to be kind of like making sure that his people or her people were actually, you know, taken care of. I think here that and this is something, it's so funny, man, because I was talking to my wife about this the other day. We went to Seven Brews over here in where I live at in Palm Bay. And we're like, okay, we're looking at the shoes for the kids that are working there. And I'm like, why doesn't the owner of this establishment just makes it like a loyalty program within the employees? Says, hey, man, if you've been working here for 6 months, I'm going to buy you some Hukka shoes. $175, I don't care. You have already given me enough. And I'm just giving you a little incentive, like saying, hey, thank you for your service to my company and to my establishment. I want to make sure that your shoes are the top of the line for you to perform at your highest level. We do with the medical practices. You get an incentive to being at your job, right? You get paid, you get compensated. Yet again, you get the tools needed to perform your job. Why wouldn't the guys working in the first line, you know, do the same? I don't know. I thought it's just a notion, you know what I mean? Maybe if I was in the other side of it and be like, well, I got 20 employees and that's $175 a pop. That makes it to $3,500 a freaking year. And it's like, okay, then I'll think about it twice. But for me, if I'm making $100,000 every single month selling coffee, like $3,000 doesn't really matter to me at that point.
So, yeah, I think so often the people making these decisions don't face any difficulty with this, right? Maybe they sit down all day so they don't need good shoes, or they're indoors in comfy air conditioning.
Yeah.
And they don't need to worry about heat. I mean, I'd be very surprised if people who sign this bill work outdoors. I'll bet not a single one does, in which case, a little bit of hypocrisy here.
Right. I used to be a betting man, and I'm going to go back to that man once again. Yeah, I'll bet you 100% that they ain't working outside. The only work they do outside, 100%, bro. The only work they do outside is like walking from their car to the air conditioning office that they sit in with their probably $3,000 leather chair, Italian leather chair. You know,
yes,
it's gotta be fancy. It's gotta be fancy.
Can't have that low quality, not
Italian. No, come on. You can't have this $90 freaking, you know, gaming chair. Like, come on, man.
Exactly. Yeah,
right, no, we're not gonna do that. Yeah. So, with that being said, and going back to the lines of fatherhood and being a family man, this is an interesting video that I found and I wanted to share with you, Dustin. And it's an interesting philosophy, right? We were talking about it. Wasn't anti or neonatalism or
antinatalism. Yeah.
And I found this to be not necessarily a disturbing video, but I found it to be interesting because at one point I think that every person, probably in their 20s, feels this way because you don't understand the actual implications of being a parent. The only thing that you see is the negative of it. you think of like, oh, I can go clubbing all night, or I can take care of a child at 2 o'clock in the morning when he starts, you know, being hungry.
Well, or, with this philosophy is a little different though.
Okay, so gotcha.
if you don't want to have your own kids, yeah, you don't need to. I'm not going to force that on you. If you don't right. want kids, I think, you know, but antinatalists say that no one should have children.
Oh,
that the act of that's gotcha. Why it's different. And that's why it's concerning. Yeah. Gotcha, so they're saying gotcha. That the act of procreation is immoral.
Oh, okay. Well,
that is crazy.
Yeah. Let's,
that's a whole different level. Yeah. See what you
let's watch about. The video. Let's see what this, possible alleged crazy would say very, yeah. very soon. Let's see.
That the most unethical thing you could do
oh, there it is.
Have children. Well, maybe not, but there is a philosophical justification for why our generation are increasingly choosing not to have kids. And the philosophical theory is called antinatalism, or the idea that it's inherently unethical to have kids. The reasoning behind this theory is pretty simple. When you're in the womb, you cannot consent to being born.
This is and so dumb.
You cannot consent to being born.
I'm sorry, but this is so dumb.
Especially that is now facing, you know, genocide, climate change, discrimination.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
You can't choose the family you're born into. Mm. You can't choose the body you're born into. You can't choose the socio and economic issues that you might face just through the family that you were born into and the place you were born into. You can't choose any of that. 99% of your struggles in your life are going to be determined by how and where and when you were born.
No, not even 100%, not even close. Yeah,
your parents decide all of that for
that's
you.
The crux of the failure. There are
yeah.
generation are increasingly realizing that saying that you want to have kids or you're ready for a family or you want to have a big family, none of those are actually sufficient reasons for bringing another human being into this world.
Her tone is killing me too. Like, someone had talent, so like,
yeah.
And a human being that is not going to have a say about any of the issues they face as a result of being brought up by you in your family and wherever you live.
Yeah, because you seem to be having such a bad life.
Feminism is a very strict theory, and it argues that, you know, no matter what you do to try to mitigate the effects and the consequences of bringing this child into the world in a non-consensual way, it's still inherently unethical to make that decision. What do you guys think?
Okay.
What
do you think, Dustin, after hearing this wonderful young lady talking?
So many thoughts. So six months ago, Elon posted something about the extinctionists against humanists.
Yes.
Basically saying that even if you're not religious, if you're a humanist, if you believe that humans are good, that you have a inherently different view of the world than people who believe that humans are bad, that because we cause climate change or because you know, we've gone to war in the past, that we're inherently a bad species and the world would be better off if we didn't exist. Right. That's kind of the argument that you're hearing increasingly from people like antinatalists.
Correct.
And it's very weird to be anti-team human, right? Can you imagine right. being a person and just thinking people are bad? But there's yeah, millions yeah. of people who think that. They think that because their parents had them and they didn't get to choose whether they wanted to be born or not, that that was unfair and they'd prefer that that had never happened.
Okay. This is
so yeah, it's a weird way of looking at the world. And I don't know how you have any kind of positivity or any desire to make the world a better place if you think that the people on the planet are bad.
Right.
So it's kind of a non-starter as far as a philosophy. There have been kind of death cults like this in the past. Like
the
Shakers of the 1800s were.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
They were in Pennsylvania, right? And you weren't allowed to have children.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And of course they died off and there's no Shakers anymore. And
with imagine any luck, how. The,
yeah, I know, weird, right? Yeah,
that's so weird.
So with any luck, the same will happen to the antinatalists. But the challenge with it is that it is a growing philosophy. And 200 years ago, you could only spread information so quickly.
Right.
Right. So if a small group of 10,000 people all decide not to have kids, within a generation, that idea dies.
Right.
But with the internet, bad ideas can spread just as quickly as good ideas.
Correct.
And so in theory, you know, if I don't know, let's talk about, you know, it's a Think Like the Enemy podcast. Yeah. If I'm China and I feel like I'm losing to the West,
mm-hmm.
how do I affect the West in a negative way three generations from now? Maybe I make an app that encourages people subtly that having children is bad, that working is bad, that their government doesn't like them, and that life is generally bad, and there's really no point to trying to make society better, right? Okay. Which is all I see on TikTok, by the way. Right. Whenever I open up a video, it feeds me, you know, people doing silly things and saying, you know, having children is dumb. You should go out and drink and do drugs, and that's a better, you know, go be a hedonist, I think. So if I were an enemy of the West, I would subtly encourage, because I can't affect 40-year-olds. We already think that we're going to think it's too late, but I can get their kids.
You sure can. I think it's very interesting, because I have talked about this before on the podcast and on any other platform that I've had the chance to. I think that this notion that, you know, TikTok is just a company, they're just trying to do their thing, man, like Snapchat, you know, everything like that. It seems like it's a very, you know, misplaced trust on the company itself. Because the message has enough, I would say, psychological elements to them, and they're very well crafted. Not particularly this one, right? You can see that this is just the opinion of an individual. But have you looked at the ones that have, which they awed me, they really do, they impress me. The ones that the people are making paper, or they're making clothing out of like some weeds that they found in the backyard in the Chinese, you know, rural country. That to me is amazing, because it's another piece of, you know, mankind. But then it's like, are they portraying China as we can do it all kind of thing? Or are they actually just showing you some piece of content that has nothing to do with, you know, the CCP for that matter?
Yeah.
I find that to be extremely interesting. And the perception too, then, you know, I don't know if you feel the same way about this, but I think that our country is sincerely being attacked from all angles at all times. Different actors have different, I would say, purposes within their actual actions and their geographical, you know, confines and whatnot. And it is something that as a nation, we will always have to endure in one shape or form. And that to me ties it into what we were talking about before, you know, started recording, centrism. Like you said to me before, 50 years ago, everybody pretty much was a centrist in America. We wanted to get along in a way that wasn't pissing off the other side, but staying true to our morals. Where do you think centrism is today in America? Is it even possible, or is it dying?
That's a really great question. I think that if you're not on social media, you see a lot of centrism. You see a lot of consensus and a desire to come together and connect. Okay. I know I personally, if I'm at dinner with somebody, the last thing that I want to do is bring up a divisive political idea so that they're not going to be my friend, right? Why would I do that?
Understandably so.
But online, I have algorithms that encourage me to do that, right? Because if I post kittens and flowers, I get a couple friends that say, hey, that's really cute. But if I post this divisive, controversial idea, I'm going to have people fighting me and then people defending me. Before you know it, the post goes viral and I've gotten a bunch of attention.
Right.
So unfortunately, if you want attention on social media, you have to be controversial.
Very, very true. I think that it's a really interesting notion, the one that we're living in America. Because our constitutional republic needs debate. It needs debate to be healthy. It needs debate to actually expand the ideas on both sides. But the only way that we can get there, if we understand that in the end, we're all Americans. That's what we need to understand. We don't necessarily all have to bleed, you know, red, white, and blue, but we all need to bleed. This is a land of the free, home of the brave. This is our constitution. This is what we have to work with. How can we make it work? It doesn't need to be people shouting at each other in the halls of Congress because somebody doesn't want to pass abortion laws. It doesn't need to be, we need to fund more money for X, Y, or Z war. Like, wars never go away. They just transcend into something else. Yeah. What really bothers me, like, you know, honestly, and I think it's something that it could possibly bother you too, is that the idea of centrism is being attacked from both sides right now. because it is being actually attributed to a form of Marxism. And if you start reading the Communist Manifesto and everything else with it, Marx, within his actual writings, talks about the two R's, meaning that a centrist is two R's away from either a reform or a revolution. So that's where you can actually grab it and say, okay, centrism is bad. Let's take it over here. That's what I think both sides of the actual aisle have successfully actually crafted in a way that the narrative works for both sides.
Well, it's that classic, if you're not with us, you're against us.
Correct.
Right? I think that was a George Bush quote, right? And unfortunately, that's not true at all, right?
Absolutely.
If I'm not a strong right winger or a strong left winger, that doesn't mean that I'm not with either side. It just means that I'm thinking independently.
But
so many Americans think that if you're not on my side, that must mean that you're against me. Right. So if you want a third party, for example, oh, but that would mean that we get another Biden term. That would be bad. Or, oh, that would mean we get another Trump term. And that would be bad. It's the same rhetoric from either side. You can't think independently. You have to be on my team or the evil devil guy, whether that's Biden or Trump, depending on, you know, who you are. It's the same argument. It's just this very 1984, you know, kind of back and forth.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know, man. I haven't in my family particularly. We like talking about things openly. I mean, like, if you're right wing, you're right wing. If you're left wing, you're left wing. If you're in the middle, then you're in the middle. We don't care. But we will definitely debate it.
Yeah.
I love and it's that. Very respectful debate, right? You know, I have a particular, you know, family member that this person is like pushy. I mean, like pushy to the point that you feel a little harassed, but then you bring it down a little bit and you bring a different point and you try to finesse it in a way that ideas are still flowing, but yet again, you're being respectful. I'll give you a perfect example. We were having dinner in Fort Pierce, like right around, I think it was like their Jetty Park down there. And it was like a nice little bar. I've never been to it. I don't drink. Not when I'm, you know, concealed carrying or anything like that. So I was just having a Coke or anything like that. Just having some appetizers, my wife, my kid, everybody. News channel comes on. They show a piece of news, and this particular family member starts talking about it. And I was like, hey, I don't feel the same way, but why do you feel this way? And she gave me her point of view. I was like, okay, I never thought about it that way. I don't necessarily have to agree with what you're saying, but your perspective, I have not thought about, and I will definitely research it. And I did. And up to a point, she was right. I was like, okay. And I literally called her up when she got on the plane after she got off. I was like, hey, you were right. Thank you for showing me that. That's it. She didn't change my perspective. She just gave me another point of view for me to research and for me to make my own educated guess.
Love that.
Why is it so hard for Americans to do that?
So you came at it from a point of curiosity and you were willing to learn.
Absolutely.
Right. I think a lot of people who are drawn, especially to Exit as a political platform, they're not there to learn and be curious. They're often there to drive a point home. Maybe they work for a political candidate.
Right.
And so their whole goal is not to learn from other people. It's to convince people of their ideas. And when your whole goal is to win, you're not curious anymore. You're not trying to learn and you're not willing to befriend someone with different ideas. You're just trying to win your argument.
And I get it.
Many of us are so married to our ideas that it's a huge part of our identity. And so if I genuinely think that my big political issue is the most important thing in the world, then I'm not going to look at it from other ways, right? It's like, so I went to the University of North Carolina, right? Huge, diehard Carolina basketball fan.
Oh, there you go.
If someone went to Duke, I can't help myself. I'm just a little bit less likely to, you know, Duke, you know, kind of thing. Sorry to hear the Duke fans listening.
No, it's okay. They'll be all right.
But it's that same kind of thing, right? Yeah. Is that weird, irrational love that I have for this light blue uniform. Makes no sense, right? It's silly, but I'm obsessed with it. Anytime I see Carolina gear, I get excited.
We're like, yeah.
Someone who went to the same college, and it works the same way with politics.
Yeah, it does.
Right? If you're a Democrat and you meet another Democrat and it's a really big thing for you, you guys are comrades and allies. And if someone says the opposite, I'm a Democrat, you're a Republican, you're a lot less likely, you know, and that's an unfortunate situation to be in. And I don't think politics should have that same kind of team and exclusion of the other that other kinds of things have. I think it's pretty harmless to like a basketball team, but if you are that obsessed with your ideas and your political leanings, you're not going to be curious and you're not going to enjoy other people's ideas.
I think for me, it helped out that I came from a family that was extremely to the right in Puerto Rico. When I say extremely to the right, I mean like governors that were running were going to my grandmother's house.
Oh, wow.
Like that kind of political stuff. My mother ran for office at some point in her life, too, after she got out of law school. So she wanted to be a political figure in her own right, right? Because every citizen has a right to run for office if they feel like it. And it was more on the township level. She wanted to be the mayor of our town, but she didn't get tapped for, you know, for office. And the one thing that they always told me, and this is something my father always, and I remember this, he was like, it doesn't matter what you believe in if you're not willing to listen to the other side. The other day, it doesn't really matter because your perception is not 100% true until you debate it and you make the facts true. Yeah. Again, this man dropped out of school at eighth grade and he had that level of comprehension on politics and on centrism and his morals up to a point. And I thought it was really interesting that he actually, you know, he taught me that. So I'd certainly thank him for that. Because to smart me, man. Yeah, right? Very smart. Like he was something else. But now I find myself that I went to the left, I went to the right kind of thing, you know, back and forth. And now I'm like, okay, now I have to start thinking like a real man. And it is, we have to be able to get along. And that's what I strive to do every single day. And I wish more people would do the same, man. I'm not saying that, you know, being either side is bad. It's not, you know, it's constitutionally protected. Yeah. But how far are we letting, you know, we're willing to let our experiment as a nation go until, you know, we see it completely fall down and fall through the cracks. That's what I hope we can, you know.
It was Thomas Jefferson, right? One of the founding fathers who said that political parties would lead to factions. And that was the most dangerous thing to a democratic or republic. So
absolutely.
You know, 200 years ago, he saw some of what we're seeing today, that factionalism. And
it's sad. It's just sad.
Yeah.
Like, what? Okay, you're from this faction. Okay, good for you. It's like the same thing with racism. Why do we have racism in this country? Like, what? Why do we keep, like, pulling the scab away from that particular, you know, that scar? Like, just let it heal, man. Just let it heal.
Yeah. I don't think there's that many truly, we have racist institutions, right? We definitely right. have things that, you know, benefit certain groups over mm-hmm. others, but yeah. I don't think there's that many Americans left who are truly no. racist. There's probably a million, you know, there's probably. A few, but
yeah.
But nobody takes them seriously. They're just clowns. That's fair. Yeah. I'm sure there's some of it, but it is thankfully a very dying way of looking at the world because there's no benefit to it. Everyone looks down on it. It's like chain smoking a pack of cigarettes in front of a 4-year-old.
Right.
It's kind of everyone's like, going like, what are you doing? Yeah, exactly. Right. So it's when I have friends who make mm-hmm. racist comments, I'm perfectly comfortable saying, hey man, you know, let's not, you know, and a generation ago, that would not have been the case. We'd have all just kind of laughed about it and said, I'm uncomfortable, but we'll just let it go. Right. And now it's pretty normal to say, let's not play this. You
know? Yeah. For me in the military, that was kind of like very dark humor. I mean, like ultra dark was kind of like the norm. So it's taken me many, many years to get away from that and censor myself. Because I mean, like extremely extreme. Anything you can think of that's possibly not right to say societally, that's exactly what you say in a war zone kind of thing. So it was like, well, okay.
So here's a good conversation to have is to make a funny example of something mm-hmm. is not necessarily racist if you're doing it, you know, with friends and there's camaraderie and all that, right? So that's not the example of racism I'm talking about. I'm talking about people who genuinely want to harm a different race or think that they're specifically better than a different group. Now, as far as, you know, do my friends of different races make fun of me, you know, call me cracker or whatever. Whatever. It's like, we throw it back and forth.
It's like 100%.
And I wouldn't call that racist per se. It's, you know, it's a form of bonding that men, especially in the military, you know, all kind of do together. And so
but do you need to censor yourself? Some people would think it is racist for some reason.
Yeah, that's fair.
I don't understand that. I really don't.
It's an interesting challenge, right? And for me, mm-hmm. comedy is the most sacrosanct, most important thing that we have to protect in terms of free speech.
Absolutely.
So great example, Dave Chappelle was on Netflix making mm-hmm. jokes that people found offensive. Yep. And so the employees said, he's got to go. We can't have him making offensive jokes. And Netflix looked at it and said, this is probably the greatest comedian of all time.
Right. Well, he's talking about, right.
Yeah, it is what it is. And
aside
so,
from Richard Pryor and George Carlin, he's like the greatest right now, period. So
absolute legends. Yeah. And guess what? Both of them said pretty offensive things. You know, some people might call it racist or some people might call it offensive.
Don Rickles. That's like, how far back do we want to go? Good God.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And all of them made statements that some people would consider offensive, but that is part of comedy,
correct?
Right? Is that you have to be willing and able to listen to and accept, you know, ideas that you might find, you know, potentially offensive there. But again, is that racist? No, I wouldn't say so.
I wouldn't say so either. I think that George Carlin has definitely, you know, he's now gone. I wish he was alive right now, man. Oh my God, he will have like special after special, just a day of news, and he will just go off. But like, I'm gonna tell you, this is the 70s, like, you dumbasses, like, what are you fucking doing? Yeah, like, he would be just hilarious.
Yeah, and yeah, he'd have a lot to say.
Same thing with Don Rickles. Don Rickles will be like, okay, well, we lost it. Yeah, like, it's all done, everybody. Yeah. Just wrap it up.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
The Mexicans and the Arabs are coming through the border. Wrap it up, guys. We're done. Like, this is it. Like, you know, pack it up. All right, we're going to Jerusalem now. Get back there. You know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I think it's just interesting to see how, you know, our society continues to evolve, and it will continue to evolve. But one thing that I know that we haven't lost is the ability to say that humanity's not lost. And this next piece of actual video will restore a little bit of that faith in humanity. I'm going to describe it for you guys. This is something that we saw it off camera. We were like, okay, come on, man. Like, this is just wholesome. Here we go. Here we have a very successful, like, actual player. I believe he's from Spain, Fernandez. Yeah, from Spain. And he's hugging a disabled man. Just bringing some, you know, some wholesome affection to this man, giving him his jersey. Just a moment that you kind of go like, you know what? I believe in mankind for this kind of stuff. And I bet you it took a very strong father and a very strong, you know, person to teach, not necessarily a father, but a very strong, you know, role model to teach this man, young man, how to be kind to others. And that is one thing that I think we have lost sight of in the past 40, 50 years. Kindness.
Yeah, I think we become very jaded. I would have friends who would look at that and say, oh, he's just doing it for the publicity, right? He doesn't actually want to help that kid. And if you think that way, it doesn't matter. Right. Like, it doesn't matter whether he's doing it for the publicity or he's just a nice guy. Either way, he did a beautiful thing. It's awesome. Don't worry about why. Just enjoy the fact that it happened.
What are you doing? Yeah. Why are you trying to take a dump on it? This man's, you know, like, you know, efforts to try to be a better human being. Like, come on now.
Yeah.
Like, can we be a little bit more sensible here? Like, good God.
Yeah.
But yeah, I thought it was something cool, man. And you see it all the time. You see, like, different things in social media that just kind of escape the algorithm. And then you see something really cool happening. You know, like, I don't know, a dog trying to put water on a fish. Like, you know, everybody has seen that clip. You're like,
yeah.
Does he really know that the fish is in the water? I don't know, but he kind of seems like he does. Oh, my God, that's so cool, you know. Yeah. Or, like, the cat that I saw this morning hugging his... you know, his dog friend because he was gone for 2 weeks. He was missing for 2 weeks. I was like, okay, well, like, he has affection. Maybe he wanted to bite him eventually, but I don't know that. You know, it just seems wholesome. And it seems, you know, pretty nice.
And there is so much of that. And that is the beautiful thing about social media is, you know, we knocked on social media quite a bit, you know, during this podcast, but it brought us together.
It
allows people to generate all these interesting new ideas. There's so many incredible pieces of creativity, new companies that are formed, new ideas that all happen because people met on social media who would not have met otherwise.
Absolutely. I think it's a blessing in disguise. It is one of those things. It's like, if it is used for good, then you will get good outcomes from it. If it's used for bad, then you will get the bad outcomes from it, just like anything else in life.
Yeah.
But I find what I don't like about it is that, you know, how focus is the next generation on social media and electronic devices. I don't like that. I don't like how you as a parent can lose sight of screen time, for that matter, with your child, just if you don't pay enough attention. or how many things are they exposed? For my particular situation, we do a lot of apps that actually have the alphabet, numbers, colors, you know, something that is a stimulant because my son is nonverbal. So we kind of have to play with what technology has brought us. But yet again, we also have a rule in this household that before noon, you are not touching that thing, period. That's the first thing. After 3 o'clock, you have been off of it for an hour already. So you get 2 hours and that's that. Then in the afternoon, it depends on what we're doing. Maybe you get it for another hour, hour and a half, and that's it. But it's on the learning curve, trying to teach him. And he pairs the A with the B and the Z and the cat and all that crap. He loves it and he's clapping. Okay, cool. But then we kind of go like, okay, give me that. Throw it in the back. What else can I use to stimulate your upbringing properly? That's where you go with the conventional stuff. You have the little cards, everything else like that, you know, the little cubes, everything. But I know that here in Florida, they just passed a law, right? 14 and under, you cannot have social media or anything like that.
Big fan of that. I think it makes a lot of sense.
Are you a fan of that? Okay.
So and you may disagree, but here's the argument that I'm hearing back and forth is it's our freedoms. The government shouldn't determine what we can and can't do. Here's the problem. As a parent, we don't have older kids, so we don't see this as much. But let's say my son is 12 and all of his friends have social media accounts and they're all playing at school with it. Right. I can't stop him from then getting on social media and having all the negative effects from it, even if I don't make him an account. So I'm doing everything that I can as a parent to prevent my child from getting too much exposure to this stuff, and it's still not enough. So if it's just a rule that 14-year-olds aren't allowed to use social media or anyone under, it makes it much easier for parents. And I think anything that we can do to take the burden off of parents to make things a little bit easier is worth it in that sense. So would I want to regulate 18-year-olds? No, of course not. They're adults. That's not the right thing to do. But for young children, the evidence is so strong, especially for young girls, Instagram, those kinds of things about what it's doing to their brains, suicide rates going up, depression.
Absolutely.
That I think a big hammer in this situation, as opposed to a scalpel and just saying no one under 14, is the right move here.
I think it's a really interesting, you know, side of the argument. I like it. The one thing I don't like about it is how this particular ruling in an actual court can be used under legal precedence for further censorship eventually down the line. I'm not thinking about the right now. I'm thinking 20 years ahead.
Yeah.
That's the only bad thing that I see with it.
You're thinking like the enemy. I like that.
I am thinking like the enemy. Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Because if we allow government to continue to expand its arms and legs and its reach into American freedoms, just like we have in the past 20 so years, we have given power to the president like if he was a monarch. Because right now, actual Congress doesn't need to approve a war act. Literally, the commander-in-chief can go like, we're going to war. 25 years ago, that wasn't the case.
Same with the pause here for 1 second, sure, Francisco. Go I got my son's asking me for something.
Absolutely, go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, there we go. We're recording again. Perfect. So yeah, that's where I'm at when it comes to that particular piece of law. You know, thinking a little ahead. I don't want the arms of government to be forever reaching. That's just not how I want to do it. But again, it is something that needed to happen because we see so many kidnappings, so many actual runaway teenagers across state lines, you know, being put in spots of, you know, prostitution, sexual assault, sexual abuse. It's just horrendous. So I understand why the governor would have, you know, done this law. I don't have to agree with it. And, you know, and it's totality for that matter. But I definitely agree with the thought behind the law and how it's going to be enforced. That's what I want to see, how it will be enforced. Because what is stopping a 14-year-old from actually having a social media account, or a 15-year-old? What do they have? Do they have an ID yet? Do they have to have a learner's, you know, a permit already, you know, driver's permit, so you can tell if they're an actual 15-year-old or not? You know, a lot of components that need to be thought about behind this particular law. I think it's going to be interesting to see how it unfolds and how far, you know, is the legislature here willing to put a stop or put an actual chokehold on the corporations that are going to be dealing with the social media accounts and such. That's, you know.
Yeah. And then if you're 15 years old, you've never had any kind of social media, and you're suddenly thrust into Instagram, it's going to be like this, you know, really weird experience for you. Whereas if you'd had a little bit of exposure when you're younger, it wouldn't be. So, yeah, I don't know. There's no perfect way to do
it. There is not. There's not. But I think it's, you know, it's a move that is interesting. It's helpful for the parents for sure. I have a 16-year-old niece, and she's been on social media for the past, I think, year and a half, 2 years. She's been doing pretty good. Her parents monitor her activities, you know, up to a point. Is it on the parents' upbringing for them to, you know, be vigilant or be not? I don't know. I honestly don't know. I don't have the formula for it. I'll tell you personally, I don't really would have a, I would have a say on it, but I wouldn't be opposed to my son having social media after 16. You know, I will definitely show him how to use it, and, you know, with my account or anything like that, but not the exposure that you get on the normal algorithmic, you know, sense. I don't think that's healthy. Yeah. I think that is alienating our society in a point, in a way. You know, you see more of this and you see more of this. And I hate that. I hate going to a restaurant and just seeing that, man. I'm like, just put the freaking phone down, man. Look at the other person in front of you. Just talk. Like, good God. Like, what happened? I don't know. That's just me.
Yeah, and I'm certainly guilty of it. I know when it's just information for scrolling, mm-hmm. I have no problem turning something down. But if I have a notification from Francisco telling me, hey, the podcast is ready, come check it out, it's so hard for me to not look at that. You know, I need to just put the phone away. So when you have friends and connections on social media, it becomes much harder to tear away from it.
I agree with you. You know what we did on when we go camping? Shut it.
Shut it. Love it.
Shut it. I don't care. For the kid, it's a little bit different. He gets a little bored and stuff like that. An hour here, an hour there. Okay, cool. If it goes off, it goes off, and you're not getting it till next day. That's it, buddy. That's it. Yep. So I pray that that thing goes off, like, goes out of battery.
After
he turns it on, it's like,
That's just me. For sure.
Yeah. All right, Dustin. Closing statements. What are you working on? What is your next podcast? Where people can find you?
So if you want to look for me on X, it's Dustin the Dad, at Dustin the Dad. Our podcast, the Present Fathers Podcast, is anywhere you get podcasts. That's going to be Spotify, Apple, YouTube, any of those. Just look for the Present Fathers Podcast. We have a nice big lineup coming up of future guests. Nice. We interview all kinds of different dads. Occasionally, we had Dr. Meg Meeker on a little while ago. She's a huge advocate for dads. Yeah,
very awesome.
Mm-hmm. Not always, but usually we interview dads. We spotlight them. We look at their specialties, and we get as much knowledge as we can from them and pass that on to our fellow dads.
Very cool, man. I love it. Going to make my closing statement, and then that will be it for today. So for everybody out there, this has been Mr. Dustin Burham with the Present Fathers Podcast, a very interesting podcast that you should take a look at on YouTube, Apple Podcasting, and Spotify. That's where they're actually at, and I cannot wait until they have their next episode on. This has been a very unorthodox episode of Think Like the Enemy, one that I think I have enjoyed sincerely. I've enjoyed it a lot. We were going for about 45 minutes. We were going for an hour and 18 minutes. So time flies when you're having fun, my friend. That is for sure. Thank you, Dustin, again for being here. Thank you to everybody watching. God bless you. God bless America. And remember to always think like the enemy. See you in the next one.